Coming up on today's program.
Much of Ohio was really excellent habitat for mastodons and other Ice Age mammals. A lot of spruce forest, the kind of forest we find further north in Canada today.
The return of an Ohio Ice Age relic. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WISO Weekend. As always, thanks for sharing your weekend with WISO. That story coming up later in our program. Up first, Olivia Green was a 2025 fellow with the HBCU Radio Preservation Project. She recently penned a reflection on the year she spent preserving the vibrant history and cultural resources of historically Black colleges and university radio stations. So we wanted her to share that experience with our listeners and get some background on the project.
The HBCU Radio Preservation Project is a Mellon Grant-funded project over the course of 4 years, where we're working to preserve the voices and the memories and the physical audio materials that are coming out of public radio stations at HBCUs. And so as a project, we kind of have two sides of things. On one, the side that's connected to WISO primarily is kind of our oral history efforts. So we go in, we make site visits at these radio stations, kind of establish relationships with the people on the ground, and try to find, you know, who to best narrate kind of the stories of these stations. Sometimes we're lucky enough to be able to still have, you know, the very first students on air. Like sometimes they're, you know, still around and we get to talk to them about what it was like to be at a station when it first started. We also love talking to current students that are there learning right now. But we also focus on managers and station engineers, community listeners, people that have been entrenched in the community and have felt the impact of the radio station over its lifetime. And so as a fellow, I was primarily working alongside the oral history projects. But on the other side of things, we also partner with the Northeast Document Conservation Center. And their role is identifying the physical audio materials and the original programming that exists on, you know, the old reel-to-reels and the DAT tapes and the cassettes and even CDs, and making sure that those can be archived and digitized and given back to those stations so that they can, you know, use them and have them preserved.
I know from experience with our archives at WISO that it's unfortunate that many of the materials and media that could be archived have been lost over the years. So when you find material that is already and good to go for the archives, it really is just a meaningful treasure.
Oh, of course, especially because, you know, if you think about how, you know, radio stations are running on the day-to-day basis. A lot of these stations are small. They don't necessarily have the people power to make sure that they're thinking it with a preservation first mindset. So a lot of times, you know, it's not intentional, but you just don't have the time and the people when you're trying to also maintain a production schedule and make sure that there's things on air, right? And so what this project does is really like we serve as a resource more than anything to say, okay, we'll come in here and we'll do it for you for free. Like there's nothing that you have to do. And like we have people that are experts in this and they know where to look. And it's so interesting because if you look at kind of some of the pictures that our project has taken of our process, like you'll see us And the preservationist especially, they're, you know, going into closets that haven't been opened in 20 years and finding keys to a filing cabinet that's lost. And then you open it and, oh my gosh, there's all this original programming in there. So it really is like, I think once we get in there and people understand what we're looking for and why, like when they get to hear it again for the first time, it's like, oh yeah, like we're sitting on so much.
From your personal perspective, what has your experience with the HBCU Radio Preservation Project done for you personally?
I think there's so much, but the main thing that I always say is just like it's kind of felt like a refocusing to me in the sense that I was really focused on like doing hard news and stuff like that for a while. And I kind of enjoyed long form storytelling and the reason that oral history was interesting to me was because I loved like the interview process and the process of doing a long form interview. But I think it's refocused me in the sense that I have this newfound appreciation for memory work. And we talk about memory as being kind of this fragile thing that is not necessarily reliable all the time. You're not going to necessarily understand the exact like who, what, when, where, and why of a situation when you're talking to somebody who's recalling something from 20 years ago, right? But what oral history does and what those interviews do is contextualize. Like I always say, it's like the connective tissue of the archive. Like it's not the thing itself, but it's how we understand why they're important. You understand how people felt in the moment because people might not remember details, but people never really forget how something made them feel. And so a lot of the times in these interviews, like you get people to talk about things that they haven't even thought about since it happened. And like the catharsis that you see people have in those moments is definitely something that I don't take for granted. It's a two-way thing. And it's like, okay, we're having this memory exchange and experience together. And we're also creating meaning about a moment together. So I understand how you felt in this moment. And then maybe we can go back and find the programming that happened on that day, the campus news that was happening on that day. And even if the details aren't exactly the same, it's like, okay, I understand why you feel this way about this thing. And I understand why you made the decisions that you made after you graduated because of contextualizing the vibe, for lack of a better word, that you were existing in. And so I think, yeah, like I have this honor for memory, not as something fragile, but as something resilient and as something that's necessary for us to contextualize and truly understand our history as individuals and as a collective.
Let me ask a final question, if I can ask, what's next for you?
Yeah, so I'm actually kind of staying on in a contract position as a digital storyteller with the project. We're in a space now where we're doing a lot more kind of digital storytelling, not only with some of the archived materials, but with oral history. So, for example, we're working on a Black History Month series for WYSO. So I'm helping cut down some of our interviews into little mini episodes about specifically Central State University in Wilberforce, which was actually, I think, the first HBCU radio station to get a license. So that's really special to have kind of those local stories and to get to interact with that community more. So I'm doing that. I also like freelance as a reporter. I'm based in New York City, and so I do a lot of public radio work here as well. And I also work in communications at a law firm. So I have like a lot of things going on, but digital storytelling and audio storytelling is definitely hard work for me. So I'm happy to be able to continue my relationship with the project and with YSO.
Olivia Green with the HBCU Radio Preservation Project, thanks so much for your time and all the effort that you've put into the project. Good luck with everything.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me.
Last week, the Dayton Daily News issued their findings of an investigation revealing how Kettering Health provided $3.2 million in excess benefits to hospital executives and leaders of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. We spoke with Josh Schweigert, Dayton Daily News' editor of investigations, to learn more about it. Josh, thanks for speaking with us. This is a pretty important story, and my understanding, it's been in the works for quite a while. The investigation stems from an internal audit that Kettering Health did in 2023.
Yeah, so in 2023, Kettering Health completed an internal audit that followed concerns and allegations that had been voiced previously about spending at Kettering Health, the hospital network. They announced in 2023 that their internal review was completed, but there were no details provided at that time about the scope of what they found, how many people were involved, the dollar amount. They said that the investigation looked into, quote, allegations of inappropriate fiscal and operational management at Kettering Health. And at the conclusion of their audit, they said that they made changes to key personnel, policy, and governance structure. What they didn't announce was the substance of their findings, who was involved, how many people, what dollar amount. And so that's what we've been able to obtain records to shed light on that information.
You've been looking into this for a while. I imagine it's taken some time to get a hold of the tax documents you needed to get to look into this.
Yeah, so the documents were filed as an amended file to a previous filing. So long after 2022, they filed an amended 2022 tax filing, which, to get into the weeds, included something called a Schedule L, in which is where a nonprofit would have to notify the IRS of any quote-unquote excess benefits, which is money paid out to people who should not have received it, or funds or benefits provided to people who either shouldn't receive it or that was received in excess of the services provided by those people to that organization. We were able to obtain other documents also that provide a little bit more detail than what's publicly accessible that shed light on some of the specific expenditures. So the tax documents get into dollar amount, $3.2 million in excess benefits provided to 46 current and former hospital executives and officials with the Seventh-day Adventist Church. That information's in the accessible tax filings we were able to obtain. Additional records we obtained provided a little more detail about the nature of those benefits. That included expenses to decorate at executive homes, to take trips to Paris and Rome, a whale-watching trip in Maui, some of the details about how the funds were expended, and what some of these excess benefits consisted of. That came in documents we were able to obtain.
I understand there's a state investigation that's still taking place.
The Ohio Attorney General's office would not comment on the investigation, but Kettering Health made it clear that they are cooperating in an ongoing Attorney General's office investigation. And so there are people who are looking forward to finding out what the outcome of that's going to be.
What else did you hear from Kettering?
I mean, Kettering Health emphasized that they conducted an internal investigation in 2023. They emphasized that they made changes following that investigation to their staffing, to their governance structure, to their policies, and that individuals implicated in this are no longer with the organization, is what they said. They made it clear that they're cooperating with the Attorney General's office investigation. Similar comment came from the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Many of their leaders are also referenced in these tax documents as receiving excess benefits from the hospital. As many people are aware, the Seventh-day Adventist Church is ingrained with Kettering Health in the management, and a lot of the leaders at Kettering Health are affiliated strongly with the SDA Church, and the SDA Church appoints board members to the Kettering Health Board. I mean, Kettering Health is an Adventist hospital network and has been since its inception.
What else do you want to highlight about this article?
There is a lot of detail in the story. It's on our website at DaytonDailyNews.com. We do have a full list of all 46 individuals who are named in the tax documents. Perhaps worth noting is that Kettering Health points to the fact that a majority of those who are reported as receiving excess benefits have corrected that, which generally means they paid it back. There are several individuals who are reported at this point as not paying it back, including Fred and Mary Kay Manchur. The former CEO of Kettering Health and his wife, they, according to the tax documents, received about $1.5 million in excess benefits, which is the largest out of the entire list. They are listed as not having paid anything back. There's a couple other people who've allegedly, at this point, not paid anything back, according to the hospital network. All that information is in our story and on our website.
Josh Schweigert is editor of investigations for the Dayton Daily News. Thank you so much. And again, we encourage people to check out the full article.
Thank you.
All right. Cincinnati-based band Space Chase Lounge performed live on Kaleidoscope recently and spoke with host Juliet Fromholt about their journey so far as a band and their upcoming tour. Here's part of that conversation.
Space Chase Lounge live on Kaleidoscope on YSO and Novaphonic. Welcome, y'all.
Thanks for having us.
So the audience cannot see that I can see and that I saw during soundcheck is that there's some instrument switching that happens between y'all. How does that kind of work within your writing process? Like, how do you know, Jordan, like, okay, this is a guitar song for me, or this is, you know, something I'm going to sing on, or Jim, you know, I'm going to do keys, or I'm going to do bass, or I'm going to do something else. How does that manifest for you all as you're creating a song?
I think basically like what Jimmy said, we have a lot of half-baked ideas, and we kind of bring them to the table, and kind of however you wrote the song, that's kind of the instrument you're playing, and then...
Yeah, typically pick whatever I started on, and I might have ideas for what I want the other instruments to do, but, like, yeah. other times it's, I just have no idea, and it just kind of... We just kind of bounce stuff off each other and just kind of try and fit stuff together until it works. I don't know.
It's really organic.
Yeah, I think the main thing is that we're just hanging out, having fun, playing music together, and then, like they were saying... Jim and Jordan knew each other and invited Jordan. And Jordan was like, well, my sister sings really good. And yeah. Like, yeah, we'll come over and we'll hang out and jam on some music. And then I think we just kind of happened on a couple of songs, or we just played some riffs for a while. We're like, that's, you know, we've played this riff for 2 minutes. Like, let's try to make it into a song. And I think that's how we kind of started realizing that we could be a band. So
I think that Jack brings a lot of ideas that are very... unconventional sounds, which is really helpful, because on our EP, I feel like you can tell we were trying on different genres and just trying to see what fit and worked. And after that, I think Jack was always unconventional, but maybe like you really came out of your shell after the EP and had, you know, more ideas that were fresh and new. And
Like a little more of a defined role. Like Jack did used to also, he used to play some songs on bass. And our process has sort of changed since the beginning, where he's really the lead guitarist at this point, and we try not to play the song Jack plays bass on, because it's just more tangling up chords. But like, to me, the changing of the instruments and all this stuff is just like shows the like overflowing creativity, and also that the mm-hmm. overflowing ADHD symptoms that are in this group, and we just get bored easily, and we also just have like too many ideas, and so I think we're all just have stayed really open and like kept it really authentic in a way where if Jim comes with a keyboard part, I might play bass, but if Jim is already on bass and Jack's playing guitar, I might play keyboard. I don't know, just whatever feels right, and that's really a like fun way to do it, but it does make it hard on stage.
Yeah.
Well, what has it been like taking this music, you know, from jamming amongst friends and sort of picking out those parts to getting out on stage in the community? How has that step been for you all?
I think we have like just such supportive friends and people around us that our first show ever was like a house show at Jim's house, and we had, I don't know, like
there was a lot of people. There should not have been that many people in my house.
We just have homies, and like, our friend Justin, he like is at every show, like never misses a show. Like we have just some people who are really great. Shout out Justin.
Shout out, like we call them the board.
Yeah, the board of the band. The band,
and they're the ones that are always there, and they really supported us at the beginning when it was really hard to get out there, and it's a lot more scary. You know, we did one open mic. That was an experience.
And Cincinnati just has a pretty, you know, approachable like DIY music scene. So that helps a lot just being in Cincinnati.
Yeah. And the Midwest, like, I don't know, it's such a welcoming environment too. And I think my favorite part about it is that music is a source of community. And that's like my favorite part about the band is like, playing is awesome. We have a really great set. That's awesome. But like my favorite part is getting off stage and like going to talk to people. Especially if it was a really good set, you can feel that you gave them energy, you know? So.
Absolutely. We're at the start of a new year. What are y'all planning for or hoping for in 2026?
We are releasing an album.
Yay!
And we are going on a little weekend tour through, I guess I would call it the Midwest, a little Midwest tour. Mm-hmm. Just last year was really a big push to finish an album, all DIY. And so this year, our big goal is just to get it out there and have a lot of fun playing it and like expanding our friend group that shows up to things, right? Expanding our fan base and And I know Jack's always eager to get back to writing new music, so.
The tour is, like, it's 10 spots, so it's pretty extensive. We're doing hidden Chicago, Detroit, Pittsburgh, a couple closer places like Dayton, Columbus, so it'll be really fun.
Athens.
OUO,
yeah.
Yeah, we all have full-time jobs, so we're doing it on, like, weekend, then the next weekend, then the next weekend, so.
Yeah, it'll be a little spaced out, but it's our first try, so.
Spaced out is the only way to do it.
When is the album coming out? Do you have a date set yet or a month? Yeah. Or?
So it comes out, we just released our first single January 1st. It's called Circles. We just played it. It was the last song. And then actually our next single, which comes out on February 1st, it was the first song, Retrograde. And our album comes out on March 14th. We have a show opening at Motor in Cincy. If you want to stop by, you're more than welcome.
Nice. Very nice. And where should folks connect with you to keep tabs on when you're going to be coming to a city near them, the next album and the next after that and all that good stuff?
I'd say Instagram is probably the best place to find us and find all the information that you need. The shows are up there. The music links are up there.
Yeah, our link tree's on there as well. So yeah. There's tickets or, you know, different dates. It's just Space Chase Lounge, all one word. But Chase has an I, like
the
chair.
Yeah, we should clarify. Chase as in a Chase Lounge.
Yes.
Fantastic. Well, this is such an exciting year for you all. I'm so excited about the new album and all of the upcoming live dates. But we are talking to Space Chase Lounge. They hail from Cincinnati and are coming to a city near you as they celebrate their album release. The album is coming out March 14th. There's a single called Circles that is out now and another single coming on February 1st. Check them out on Instagram.
Slowly winds down the gray return and tangle you in a sting in your arm. Though everything said we, it's only
this is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks for sharing your weekends with WISO. Up next, it's Today from the Ohio Newsroom, and we've got Bird Note to wrap up our program.
Today from the Ohio Newsroom, the return of an Ice Age relic.
Support comes from Cerity Partners. Cerity Partners' Cleveland-based wealth management practice is a neighbor offering objective advice with national strength and resources. Information available at CerityPartners.com/NPR.
Today from the Ohio Newsroom takes you around the state, connecting you with news and neighbors from all over Ohio. I'm Kendall Crawford. In 1978, residents in the small community of Winnemeg in rural northwest Ohio discovered the skeleton of a mammal dating back to the Ice Age, a mastodon. A piece of the 12,000-year-old fossil was recently donated to the Museum of Fulton County nearly half a century after its discovery. Peg Yakabuchi, professor of geology at Bowling Green State University, joins us to tell the story behind the fossils. Hello.
Hello.
Take us back in time to the Ice Age when the mastodons were roaming. What do they look like, and why was Ohio such a good habitat for them?
So the Ice Age started about 2 million years ago, and during that time, large ice sheets expanded and then melted back again multiple times. So the mastodons that we find throughout Ohio and the Southern Great Lakes, a lot of them are from that last glacial retreat, which happened starting about 15,000 years ago. So mastodons are a kind of extinct elephant. It is a particularly common Ice Age elephant. It's a little bit smaller than a woolly mammoth and not quite as shaggy as a woolly mammoth.
So tell me about these specific fossils. How was this mastodon skeleton discovered?
Yeah, so in the small community of Winnemeg in Fulton County, a landowner was excavating for a pond when he came across these bones. My colleague, John Howe, studied the bones. After he was done, the material was sent up to the University of Michigan's Museum of Paleontology, where much of the material still resides as part of their collection. However, the landowner and his friends helped themselves to some of the bones when they were being excavated. And so the material that's going to be on display at the Fulton County Museum was found recently in somebody's attic. And the daughter of the person who had it brought it into the Fulton County Museum.
That is such a crazy homecoming story for these fossils. I mean, how common of a discovery are mastodon bones in Ohio?
That's surprising for a lot of folks. Ice Age material is pretty common. Much of Ohio was really excellent habitat for mastodons and other Ice Age mammals. A lot of spruce forest, the kind of forest we find further north in Canada today, would have been widespread throughout Ohio back during the Ice Age. Mastodon fossils are known, in fact, from every single county in Ohio.
What do you think it means to the community to be able to display this discovery that was made in their backyard?
Being able to display the Winnemeg mastodon fossil at the Fulton County Museum is going to help to engage people, to get them thinking about what our planet has been like and how it's changed. When we think about 15,000 years ago, 12,000 years ago, that might sound like a lot, but it's actually trivial in terms of geologic time. And to think of how much Ohio's climate has changed, its habitats have changed, and how animals like mastodons, woolly mammoths, ground sloths, Ohio had a giant beaver the size of a black bear, and they all died out only about 11,000 years ago. It really tells us how quickly and how profoundly climate change can impact our habitats in the past and even looking forward.
Wow. Thank you so much. Peg Yakabuchi is a professor of geology at Bowling Green State University. Thank you for taking us back in time today.
It's great to be here. Great to talk with you.
That's all today from the Ohio Newsroom. We'll talk with you on Monday.
This is Bird Note. Birds spend lots of time keeping their feathers in top condition. This can include bathing or perhaps sunning. But the number one means of feather care is preening. When preening, a bird first grips a feather in its beak near the feather's base. Then it slides its beak along the length of the feather toward the tip. This action smooths together the tiny structures called barbules that make up the feather, while also removing dirt and small parasites. If a bird's feathers get too dried out, they become brittle. To prevent that from happening, most birds have a gland located above the base of the tail that produces oil. Birds use their beaks to massage oil from the gland into their feathers to keep them supple. But how does a bird preen feathers in hard-to-reach places, like the head and neck? Using its beak, a bird can dab oil on its toes, then comb its head feathers with its toes. Or a bird might wipe its head directly on the preen gland, or uropygial gland as it's called. Some bird pairs preen each other's head and neck, although this may be less about hygiene and more about keeping the bond between them strong and certain. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
And so it ends this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO Yellow Springs, community-owned public radio for curious listeners. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks so much for joining us this week. Our theme music is Another Beautiful Day in Paradise from Magnolia Bolthead. Don't forget, this show is a podcast. You can subscribe and download wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more conversations and highlights for you next week. Please join us then.